everyone for coming, and of course we want to thank in particular the Pleaders for hosting this evening. A heroic thank you goes to Sammy in particular, because Lori is a little bit under the weather. We wish her the refuah shleima, and I can only imagine if I had to host a large group of people and Alana
is too chilled for that
in Tokyo, I would completely panic. So, thank you very much for holding steady. We began last week with a good 30 or so sources, which can really be divided up into three groups of ideas that we mentioned last week, and I'll just touch on them to set the table for what we're going to do this evening. We discussed as a basic overview both of the halakha, of the basic obligations of what kibud avei means, honoring our parents, as well as the other pasuk from Vayikra, of shmimora, having an awe or a fear. We saw some basic halakhic definitions and a little bit of an expansion of that. And then we really saw in that first part of the shiur last week a number of the mamari chazal, a number of the very beautiful midrashim that stress the awesome power of the mitzvah, and very beautiful and almost vivid examples and imagery that were used by the midrash. We also saw, to be fair, some of the midrashim, some of the halakhos or gemaras that speak very powerfully about how difficult and how challenging it is to fulfill the mitzvah of kibud avim. As I stressed then, independent of particularly challenging situations or challenging personalities, just objectively, it's such a demanding mitzvah that it's objectively very, very difficult to fulfill. We then moved into a second part of the shiur where we discussed, from a halakhic perspective, the very fascinating possibility that is raised that perhaps, even though it seems obvious at first blush, the kibud avim is an interpersonal mitzvah, a binyan chavero, interpersonal between the child and the parents, and all of the things you have to do are those types of activities. We did see that there was a group of thinkers, perhaps the earliest one was the Ramban, who suggested from a very serious halakhic perspective that perhaps kibud avim is a mitzvah ben adam l'makom, that it's a vehicle through which we channel our relationship with Hashem, and we saw that this wasn't just a nice rabbinic drasha or something like that, but in fact, there were some folks who suggested that a very concrete nafkamina would be on Erev Yom Kippur, when we know we have the tradition of asking mechila from people who we've wronged. So the question was, if you look back over the year and you realize you haven't been a perfect child, a perfect son or a perfect daughter to your parents, so it's one thing to feel that regret and to 1 o'clock al-chayt and ask Hashem to forgive you. The question is, do you also have to do the more, you know, naturally difficult or awkward thing and ask your parents for forgiveness? And we saw that Minchas Chinuch raised the possibility that perhaps you don't. Even though it would seem obvious that you should, perhaps you don't. After all, maybe kibud avim is a mitzvah ben adam l'makom. It has to do with your relationship with Hashem. Never might be sufficient just to make your peace, so to speak, in a genuine way. Not that that's always so easy, but at least that's a real possibility, and that's a very fascinating idea. We concluded last shiur with something also I thought was very important to discuss, which is that if you look in the Gemara and the base of Shulchan Aruch, all the descriptions of the mitzvah are very much in terms of physical activities, things you must do for your parents, things you're not allowed to do for your parents. But we raised the question, and we saw a number of sources that suggested that perhaps there's also an emotional component to the mitzvah of kibud avim, that perhaps these very specific activities that we're obligated to do for them are supposed to engender a very real respect. We saw was mentioned by one source, an admiration, the thought that you're supposed to think of your parents as the greatest in the world. They should be your heroes, to use a modern term. And even if that may not be true about the totality of their personality, try to find one thing that you can really look up to them about and admire them for. We saw that Rabbeinu Yonah in his letter speak about how the Iker, he says, the primary of kibud avim is to give them nachas, and to live that kind of a life and have that kind of a relationship. And all of those were very fascinating ideas, which are not just in the Gemara, they're not even really in the Shulchan Aruch, but they seem to be the, so to speak, the inner force, the inner dimension of the mitzvah of kibud avim. And we concluded with, within that general category, we specifically discussed, if you will, the most sensitive of issues, and that is the question of love. Is loving your parents part of the mitzvah of kibud avim? I mentioned repeatedly that I hope that it's a natural part of every relationship. The question is whether it's also part of the mitzvah. And we saw that it appeared to be a machlokas. Interestingly enough, the Rambam seemed to assume that it was not part of the mitzvah from a technical perspective. But we did see the Sefer HaKaredim, which was a contemporary of Yosef Karo, lived in Tzfat around the same time. And he wrote very powerfully, very beautifully, how he assumed that the essence of kibud avim, the highest purpose of kibud avim, was that there should be a love for parents. What he described is a, quote, ahava aza, which is not just a passive love, but an overwhelming, passionate love that we have for our parents. And that even a little bit more recently, the Chayyadam, which is one of the classical Sifri Halacha, quotes this almost verbatim, and he assumes the Halacha that to be true. So very interesting different perspectives. And in light of what we saw last week, I wanted to shift gears and to do two broad topics that I believe are connected to each other tonight. I want to start off the first group of sources, the first page and a half or so, discussing the reason for the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avayim. The why question. Why do we have such a mitzvah? Which is a question that we ask ourselves about all sorts of mitzvos. It's an enterprise known as Tamei HaMitzvos. What's the reason, right? What's the symbolism? What's the reason of shofar? What's the reason of mavulav? What's the reason for the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avayim? This would seem to have a more obvious answer than other mitzvos, but we'll see that it's in fact not so obvious at all. And in light of our understanding, to take us, if you will, the most natural or common of parent-child relationships, is a natural biological parents raising those children, and that's the immediate context we're starting with. But I then want to move into the second part of the shiur, which would be to discuss other types of relationships to see whether, once we know the reasons behind the mitzvah, are those applicable to other types of relationships. And we will address a few. It could be that there were other one or two could have discussed, but the ones we will discuss are issues of step-parents, which is somebody who's married to our biological parents, step-parents, adoptive parents, that means that neither of them are your biological parents, but they're raising you. And then we'll also discuss grandparents, and we'll discuss in-laws. I think we'll hopefully have a chance to do those four categories, okay? So let's begin on source number one. And this alludes to something we mentioned last week. In fact, we saw a parallel source, but it's specifically in this form, in the Mechilta, which adds a phrase which I think starts us off on our opening topic. Our question is, why is it that we have to have honor, awe, etc. of our parents? So this is a medrash which is discussing something which we alluded to last week, which is the fact that the psukim that describe the mitzvah of kibbutz on the one hand and mora on the other hand switch around the order of who comes first, father and mother. Right? What's the pasuk kaved es avicha, honor your father, the es imecha, and your mother. Yet when it comes to the pasuk of mora, the order is just reversed. And there we're told to have mora of our imecha and only then of our father. Why is the order reversed? So it's a very famous midrashic idea. Rashi already quotes this idea that the Torah is sensitive to what should be instinctive. If you take a look at this version here in the Mechilta, the first line where I have it underlined, he says, "V'hai ha'olam, what's the way of the world? She'adam mechaved es imo yoser me'avi. Lefi shehi mishtadlasa b'dvarim." Mother usually spends more time with the children. There's more of an emotional bond. And therefore, instinctively, there's going to be more of an honor for the mother. And therefore, to counterbalance that, the Torah puts father first, kaved es avicha. However, when it comes to the other idea, if you skip to the middle of the second line, so to speak, it's revealed, it's a profound truth to God, Yoser may emo. Instinctively, children are more fearful of their fathers than they are from their mothers. So it's interesting that the reason that he gives, it's not because he gives a patch, it's not because he's big and strong. It says this medrash, at least for Pishuhu Melamdo Torah, there's a certain seriousness to the relationship. It's not just, playing ball and stuff. There's a certain seriousness to the relationship, which certainly strikes a certain fear. And there are certain families where this is more obvious than others. I'm just thinking of, I don't want to digress, but some of the stories that Soloveitchik told about learning with his father as a child, so despite the great love, there was no doubt fear between father and child, and it specifically focused on the learning that his father taught him. There was great fear here, and this is exactly what the Medrash describes. And therefore, similarly in an inverse to the first case, hikdim ha'aim la'av v'mora. So the pasuk specifies the mother first, in that way. So this idea, this basic idea, we've seen already, it's not new. But there is one phrase that is new in this medrash, which to me is very suggestive and revealing. The Lashon medrash here I have underlined, Makom Shechiser Hishlim. Wherever it was lacking, the Torah came in and added, and supplemented, and compensated for. Now why I think this is such an important, again, it was implicit anyway, but this is explicit and teases it out, is because you see something very fundamental about, it's a really a model for a lot of mitzvot, but very specifically when it comes to Kibbutz Av Aim, and that is that there is a certain natural, instinctive obligation, honor, and reverence here that we have for our parents. It's instinctive. It's already there. However, if that's the case, what do you need a mitzvah for? What do you need a Torah for? So the Torah, right, many of us have instinctive desires to be good, to be charity, etc. But there's still a mitzvah. Why? Because it's never enough. It's not enough, first of all, because we're not obligated by our instincts. Maybe we have a good impulse now, we might have a good impulse tomorrow. And second of all, even if we have a general impulse, a general instinct, it doesn't mean that we are attuned to exactly the specific guidelines that Torah would expect from us. And the paradigm of that, says the Medrash, is Kibbutz Av Aim. Makom shechiser hishlim. Which is a way of saying, instinctively, we're all drawn already to some level of awe, reverence, honor, love of our parents. But nevertheless, it comes in different forms. A little bit to the father this way, a little bit to the mother that way. But in truth, from the Torah perspective, it's not supposed to be exactly like that. It's supposed to be, actually, as much as possible, identical. You're supposed to have altogether demonstrate the same honor and reverence for your mother as the same honor and reverence for your father. It may not be instinctive, and therefore, makom shechiser, where it's not exactly instinctive, hishlim, the Torah, so to speak, it's like a cookie cutter, superimposes on top of what is otherwise natural instinctive, almost identical, but a slightly different model, which guides us and perfects what is otherwise, you know, we sometimes think about the Torah purifying our base instincts. Here we have an example where we have otherwise good, elevated instincts, and even then, the Torah needs to channel them and refine them in a very specific direction. Now, if I had to ask you, what you think is the most instinctive reason why we should honor our parents? Not some deeper philosophical reason, but if I had to say, what form or what guise do you think that instinct takes? If you had to put a Jewish, a halakhic term on it, what would you refer to it as? A karas hatov. We're thankful for that. And in fact, it's that idea that the Talmud Yerushalmi mentions, which we saw last week, but I put it on this week's first sheet again because it's relevant most definitely for tonight. In source number two, we see this idea to take into its formulaic extreme, where the opinion here in the Talmud says, refers to it as a davrish priyasog. Everything we do for our parents is like we're repaying debt. And one of the commentaries on the Pnei Moshe suggests, take a look at source number three, what's the debt we're repaying? Shekol ma'at la'avi, anything that we do for our parents, eino ela kipiron chog, we're just repaying the debt we owe them. Shegmaluhu hatova, we're repaying them, what's good did they do for us? Ve'le'dasso, they gave birth to us. Ve'gidulo, they raised us, ve'le'udo, and not only that, not only do they feed us, so to speak, but they fed us, they nourished us spiritually as well. Which are more or less two categories. They gave us our life itself, they gave birth to us, as well as ve'gidulo, they raised us. So what's interesting is that the Pnei Moshe here combines those two. The general idea, we owe our parents a debt of gratitude, literally here a debt, and therefore we are thankful to them because they gave birth to us and because they raised us. And this, generally speaking, is the first, I would refer, and really the most prominent reason given among the sources for the reason, the Tam HaMitzvah, why do we have to have Kibbutz Av Aim? Because we're appreciative, because there is Hakaras HaTov. What is interesting, and I want to spend a few moments just showing this to you, is that even though this source, the Pnei Moshe, which is a relatively modern source, blurs the line, if you will, and mixes and matches both giving birth and raising you, there are other earlier sources that specifically focus on one or the other. And it's very interesting to consider why one might be more incurring of a debt of gratitude, or why the other might be. So take a look, for example, at the Mishnah in Bava Metzia in source number 4. This is a very famous example, which is not really focused on Kibbutz Av Aim so much, but it's a related source, and clearly focusing on the first idea, the more natural idea that parents give life, literally life, to the child. So the Mishnah says in Bava Metzia that when it comes to finding a lost object, there's a mitzvah to return some of the lost object. So what if it's a really bad week for all the people that you love, coincidentally enough? Father or your mother loses something, and you, are, of all people, find it. And so, wouldn't you know it, your Rebbe loses something, and wouldn't you know you find it? So, you know, you can only do one thing at once. So, what do you do first? So, the halacha, the famous halacha, is that you're actually obligated to return the lost object of the rabbi before that of the parent. And what is the terminology that the Mishnah uses here in source number 4? She'aviv Hevil Ola Hazan, your father, and in this case it's a general neutral term, it's equally true about a mother, they brought you to this world, they gave you life. But Rabbo Shalimdu Chachma Mehiu Lachayel Lamaba. So this is an aside, it's not our topic for tonight. So it's in and of itself a very profound source in terms of our appreciation for Machankim, for Rebbeim, and the spiritual nourishment that the teachers give our children. And certainly we should always appreciate that group of people who are always overworked, underpaid, and never appreciated nearly enough. So, I'm the husband of a former teacher, so I speak from personal experience. But the point that's relevant for us is the first part that I've underlined, and this is the major stress is why would you have a debt of gratitude, why would you have a priority towards your parents? She may be a little about that. They brought you to this world, they gave birth to you, they gave you life. If you take a look at the Sefer HaChinuch here, source number 5, he also mentions both ideas. If you'll take a look, we saw this last week also, but it's worth reviewing. The Sefer HaChinuch says, Shiroilo La'adam is worthy of a person, Shiyakir, he should recognize the Yigmo Chesed, which Misha Asa Imotova. The essence of Kibbut Aveim is Hakar Satov. You should recognize and repay someone who's done something good for you. What is the good that is done? He says in the next line, you should do anything that you can do for them. Why? Excuse me, I take that back. Okay, so stop. So he focuses again on this idea of hakaras hatov and the basic debt of gratitude that we owe our parents. And again, kind of not so specified here about whether it's more for the fact that they gave birth to us. As he says here in that second line, I didn't underline it. Avein im siba hayoso ba'olam. They're the reason that you're in the world. They're your cause because they gave birth to you. Therefore, we should owe them a debt of gratitude. Now, there is a whole other group of sources. Some more, if you will, pardon. You'll see one or two of them, which are, in a certain sense, controversial, very provocative sources, which suggest that perhaps that's insufficient. Perhaps we should specifically focus and specifically downplay the fact that they gave you physical life, actually gave birth to you, and rather focus on the fact that they raised you. So if you take a look at source number 6, this is more of an anomaly, it's just not an anti, but just a choice of what to stress and what not to stress. The Sifrei says here, and the Medr says here in Devarim, referring to Kibbut Aveim, you with your parents, what you focus on, Kama Omel Lucha, Kama Yegia Yaga Lucha. You should think how much effort they put in, how much work they put in. So again, the work here is not referring to conception, it's not even referring to delivery of the baby. The work here they mean is, you know, changing your diapers and wiping your runny nose and taking you to the doctor and the worst of all, homework to do with the children. And there's a tremendous there's a lot of work that parents put in, and it doesn't even end there. It never ends. So tremendous effort that you have, that's a hakar satov. Not for giving birth to you, how far is it for raising you, for all the effort it takes to raise a child. If you take a look at source number 7, this is a very fascinating source, again, coming at it from an interesting perspective. This is from the book of Emunas Medeos, which is one of the earliest philosophical books we have, written by Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon is one of the great, most well-known of the period of the Gaonim. The Gaonim is the period, more or less, that transitions from the end of the Gemara, the end of the Talmud, to what we call the medieval period of the Rishonim, and the Gaonim, who pretty much lived in what we would call modern-day Iraq or Iran, in that area. So Rav Sadia Gaon was perhaps one of the most famous. And he has a book which is actually written in Arabic. The Hebrew that we use, that you and I would study, is a translation. It was written in Arabic originally. So he called the Munas Adeh. It's one of the earliest works of Jewish philosophy. So he's discussing reasons for mitzvos, and he's now discussing why is it that the Torah prohibits idolatry or other forms of sexual immorality. And he says it's illogical. You might think, you know, let people have a good time. Why do we have to be so, circumspect and, chaste? So he says, no, it actually makes a lot of sense. Umenach Chochmah says it makes a lot of sense. In verse number 7, Le'esor Haznus, to prohibit adultery, you'll see that's clearly his focus. First of all, important enough, Shiloyu Hamadabrim. People shouldn't look like animals. A certain elevated aspect, even to the sexual part of our lives, we shouldn't act like animals and just cohabitate with anyone. And then he adds, and this is what's more relevant for us, and what would be the result of people having, such anonymous and free relationships? You won't know who your parents are, he says, and you won't know who to give the proper kibbut aveim. There's unfortunately a stereotypical societal joke in America in the 20th and 21st century about this very fact. You don't know who your father is. At the very least, you can't keep it a bank. Lots of other problems that come with that too. But if you have a lack of a family structure, if you have a lack of fundamental morality that creates families out of the context of marriage, says Reb Sajigon already almost 1,000 years ago, you won't know who your father is. If you don't know who your father is, you won't be able to shechavdu gamusha gidlu. You won't be able to repay him. What is, how does he translate kibbut avayim? You won't be able to repay the debt for all that they did in gadlu, in raising. Again, it seems, you know, it doesn't say anything negative about the alternative possibility, but it's deliberately omitted. It has to be deliberate. It's so obvious. He goes out of his way to only stress, as we saw a little bit before in the Sifrei, the fact that parents are raising children. Now, there is a period, of course.
Of course, it could be an adulterous relationship, and then you're raised by
somebody else.
Yeah.
Right.
So it was contradictory.
But first of all, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe you'll only be raised by a single parent. But second of all, we haven't gotten to that. Will be the second part of our shir, which is, will there be kibbut avayim for the, I won't call him the father necessarily, we'll call him at least for now the man who's in your life, who's with your mother. But that's certainly a point. That's part of why I set up the shir the way I did.
I agree with Bernie. The person who isn't raising you, because why did they get in this statement?
What do you mean, why did they get in
this statement? The statement seems that you won't know the person who is your father so that you can honor them for raising you. But they're not raising you.
Oh, I see what you mean. That's very good. I don't think that's what Bernie said.
I think that's
what you mean? Oh, that's what I'm saying. Very good. Okay. I guess you have to reread it then, that he won't be able to raise you and you won't be able to. But it's a good point. I'm not here as I took a graduate course in which we critique, you know. But for my purposes now, I'm not looking at it as a graduate student. Just that he focuses, when he chooses to formulate kibbut avayim, he's focusing on the idea of raising. Now, perhaps the reason, I can't say for sure this is why the earlier sources didn't, but there was a group of sources also from a certain, I would call it a sliver, but in the Rishonim, a sliver, a period, which specifically and consciously raise the issue of certainly which one is more important, and very much unconsciously, and I think a little bit controversially, downplay the debt we owe our parents because they gave birth to us, because they gave us life. Anyone want to venture a guess? Why would you? I mean, it would seem to be at least as good, if not more of a reason. You know, whatever else is said and done, at least you wouldn't have life, but wouldn't be for them. So why would you suggest, anyone have a thought, why would you downplay that? What negative could you possibly say about the fact that people gave you life? Yes?
Because you didn't ask to be born.
Okay, that's good. But do you regret it?
Yes.
Okay. You actually hold that thing about the Gemara Erevin.
This is the Middle Ages, they probably.
They shot Alan. You see?
I'm not going to say, if you're smart as this, better not have been born.
Right, okay. That's interesting. That. So you agree here. Very good, very good. Any other suggestions? But that's not discounting it. It's just saying, even that acknowledge that you owe your parents because they gave birth to you, just that you owe the Rebbe even more, if you first choose. Yes.
Maybe what you alluded to before, that giving birth is the less difficult of the process.
Just less difficult. Okay, good.
Raising them.
Right, so that's over. Even a long labor is over in 9 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, whatever it is, right? Okay. Anyone else have suggestions? They're all logical, but they're not yet what the Sfarim say. Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
In fact, take a look. If you look at two sources here, 8 and 9, the Menorah Hamor, I'm not exactly sure of his biography, but other than that, he lived quite a few hundred years ago, and he is important enough that he's quoted in the Bar Ilan Sidi Ram. So if you take a look at source number 8, he is one of the strongest of the formulations. He says, of course, you have to honor your parents. Yoser al shalimduhu musar, more because they raised you, and again, just raised you by giving you sneakers. They gave you a way of life, they gave you ethics and values. More than al shalimduhu lo amazan. And that's more of a reason, he says explicitly, that's more of a reason to honor your parents than the fact fact that they gave birth to you. Why? Right? The act of procreating is one that's of a pleasurable act. So he is, in a certain sense, cynical. He says when a couple gets together and they're intimate, so that's their motivation. It's not that you should be able to have a life and in 20 years you'll do wonderful things and you'll owe them for that. They did that for themselves, he said. The fact that subsequently, 9 months later, there was a baby, and then they took such great care of you, and they even woke up at 2 in the morning and didn't have a Shabbos nap. I'm not only talking about my night last night. Didn't have, not even a nap, and changed a diaper in the middle of lunch. That's why you owe them, because that's clearly not for any gratification. That's just for you. But the very act that they gave birth to you, who? What's that? That was for themselves. That's his idea. I find it to be very controversial, but it's fascinating that he would say such a thing. The Chovos HaLevavos actually goes so far, it's hard to know. He really walked out on the ledge. It's hard to know. I'm not even sure when he comes back in off the ledge. But the Chovos HaLevavos, not only does he say that, take a look on the bottom of the page. Min HaYadua, Ki Hu Mechavein, Mechuvan, Rach LeToeles Atzmovo. Right? They're looking out for themselves when they procreate the parents. It wasn't just for you. But here he goes so further to say, not just according to the actual act of giving birth, but even raising you. He says, why do parents take such good care of you? Why are they cleaning up your diapers? And why are they doing your homework with you? And why are they staying up all night for letting you have keys that you know you're 16 years old? And all these things.
We're from the farm.
So he doesn't use that specifically. He says, right? All of the parents' hopes for a legacy, whether you think in very long terms or even break for a day firm head on the farm, that's why they're doing it. Why do parents take care of their children? He says again, somewhat cynically. Because you're an extension of them. It's self-absorbed. They see it as an extension of you. You'll be good, so that's reflective of them. That you'll take care of them. I mean, there's many layers, but the bottom line is he sees it as fundamentally not so magnanimous, but more selfish. So of all of that, he says, even when they're kind to you, but Hashem made them that way. In other words, it wasn't like it's a big challenge for a parent to love the child, but you owe them for that. It was a big challenge for the mother to rock the baby. This is, when we meet a mother who doesn't do that, we're like, what's wrong with you? Because the natural instinct, and Hashem made them that way. So you don't owe them. They're doing it because that's what makes them feel good. That's the instinct Hashem implanted in them. After all of that, he says, well, the second line, call them with all of that, still, again, I'm not exactly sure why after he's downplayed it so much, not only the Torah, but even it's logical, that we have to worship them and serve them and fear them. So he very much downplays, so to speak, debt you owe them, and at the same time, still says you owe them a debt. So that Chovos is really fascinating. But the one that's a little bit more clear was the earlier source, the Menorah Samor, and you see that you have some Mepharshim who blur the lines. The other Mepharshim seem to deliberately focus on the fact that they gave you life, and that's the reason you owe them a debt of gratitude. And you have others who, perhaps somewhat controversially, focus much more not on, so to speak, giving birth to you, but on all the subsequent efforts to raise you, both physically, emotionally, spiritually, etc. Nevertheless, that's what I'll call 1A and 1B, but it's all one category of sources, that the reason for Kibbutz Avayim is Hakaras HaTov, we owe our parents a debt of gratitude. There is a second approach, Kibbutz Avayim, which I also has an A and a B, although here the B is, I think, much more prevalent. The second one is that it sees in Kibbutz Avayim and a respect for parents as an instrument for another higher good. Who wants to speculate what other higher good could be implanted? In what way could the child be transformed in a productive way through the honor and reverence shown to parents? Good, very good. It gives children the most natural and early stage of their life a sense that there's such a thing called authority. There's them, and there's you. There's higher, and there's lower. Now, if you want to think about it like a grant, what are the two, in the most general sense, what are the two different options we could have, and what good ways can that help? If you will, the secular and the sacred. So, for example, the Rambam says, and I would say this is the more minority view, focusing on, if you will, the secular benefits, the Rambam says in the Mor Nebuchim, he's talking about all sorts of why certain rebellious people in the Torah get certain punishments they get. So he speaks about the Navi Sheker and the false prophet and the rebellious elders, the Zaki Mamre. So why do they get the punishment? Because they do such a terrible thing to society. What about Maka Avi, Imo Makala Avi? What if you curse your parents or you hit them, you injure them, which is a capital offense? So what's wrong with that? So not because of some objective deleterious thing in the moment, the Rambam says that's not the problem, but rather there's a long-term problem. Because what does that produce? The Rov Ha'azus Shieshbo, the level of chutzpah that it takes to have that kind of disregard and disrespect for your parents, that you would insult them, that you would hit them, Heyoso Masid Seder Habayis. You can't have a home, you can't have a family structure when there's no hierarchy. Parents who can be, children who can be that chutzpah, like the parents, so they blur the lines. There's no higher and there's lower. The bias, as he calls it, is destroyed. Without the home, comes next, says the Rambam, Shehua Chelek HaRishon Min HaMedina. The whole society, societally or politically, you need to have a hierarchy. Right? Society is built, if you have a productive society, that's because you have lots of productive families. And if you pull out the rug from under the families, if children don't respect the parents, and they're not going to respect, it sounds like by extension, the policeman, and they're not going to respect the mayor and the governor. And because you tell me, what do I have to listen to you for? I can do what I want. My parents told me I don't care about them either. So the first instrument, the way Hashem is built into the world, the first instrument, you need to know that you don't get to do everything you want, and there are certain people you have to listen to, and not listen, and listen, and you can't do certain things. The first one is the parents. And if you lose that, says the Rambam, you lose everything. So again, he, to be honest, he doesn't speak about this in the positive sense of that is the reason for keeping out the aim. He's speaking out from the perspective of if you don't have it, what are you missing? But I don't think it's a huge speculation to, so to speak, flip that around and say perhaps one of them is not the main reason for keeping out the aim, therefore, is to implant that in a person, that sense of societal hierarchy.
Perhaps a corollary of that even is the modeling that one shows for their own children by doing that, by showing that parents
of course, right, right.
Parental authority. And
right, that's for sure true. So, right, that's the old joke. If you want to make sure you don't go to a nursing home, don't send your parents. That's the, and have daughters, that's the other joke. It's a two different jokes. Neither of them are mine. They're both. But these are jokes, and you probably heard them already. These are old. And I'm a son, and I'll take care of my parents, but even now I can report that those are two cliche jokes in American culture. But be that as it may, there's a certain, certainly the first one is the truth to that. No question, we're constantly watching how our parents treat their parents. And if we see it done appropriately, it's going to have a huge impact on us. There's no question about that. So in light of this basic idea of hierarchy that is taught from Kibbutz Avim, I just want to mention that there's a whole other group of sources, and this takes us through the rest of this page, into the beginning of the next page, which talks about this not from a political perspective, which the Rambam does, but speaks about it from a religious perspective. And that is that the purpose of Kibbutz Avim is it gives us a sense of Mesorah. Our parents are our link in the chain to Mesorah. Mother and father to children, to mother and father and children. Without parents, without a reverence for parents, how do you know what you've inherited? Not just the model of it, but so much the natural transmission of the Mesorah is not in school, it's not in yeshiva, it's at home. We all know, including people in this room, who have embraced the tradition even though they weren't brought up with it. That's heroic and it's certainly unexpected. You don't build a system expecting that, of course not. The way the system is built to hopefully perpetuate itself is this transmission from one generation to the next. But if you don't trust what your parents are teaching you, you don't have that reverence for them that you can trust what they're giving them to you. It doesn't matter how charismatic the rabbi is, and it doesn't even matter how charismatic Moshe is. There's a major fault line in the foundation. A number of Mepharshim stress this. So, for example, if we take a look at the Abar Benel on the Aseres HaDibros in source number 11, he tells us, Lamadu Gamkein Yizel Lechavet HaChachamim. He points out incidentally that the original source for Bimechavet HaChachamim comes from the fact that you have to mechabit your parents, because again, it's a sense of hierarchy. And therefore, he says, in the underlying part here, "Ulihios koa hadibur hazeh," what's the real force of this dibur, of this, of the commandments? "Lahamin bekabalas harishonim." The sense that there are people who came before us that transmit, Kabbalah here is a synonym for what we call Mesorah, they've given us a tradition, and we accept it, we trust them. "Shu'ikr kolel b'torah." There's no Jewish people, there's no Torah, there's no nothing. If you don't have trust in the generation that came before you, and therefore buy into what they transmit to you. This gets back to that topic we discussed last week from the Ramban, who pointed out that Kibbutz Rabbeinu was on the right side of the Luchos, because ultimately it serves our relationship with Hashem. How is that? Harbonel tells us very beautifully, because if that, without that trust and that hierarchy of parent to child, you don't have that trust and that respect for parents, so the whole system of Judaism would fall apart. I won't read it because it's too long, but if you take a look at the Sefer Arikar, or Yosef Albo, another one of the great medieval philosophical works, verse number 12, he stresses the same idea, and in fact he gives a mashal of a king who makes a city and he has all these inhabitants, so no one expects the king to come every single day. The first generation knows the king was so mighty and so great and so benevolent to them, and built them the city and built them, created plumbing and did all those things for them. Maybe they told their children, and the children they remember as young children seeing the king, but then the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, no one ever saw the king. They just have a beautiful house and a beautiful town to live in. So they'll forget. So what does the king do? Every now and then he sends representatives and shluchim, so to speak, and say, here I am in the name of the king, and remember how much you owe the king. So says the Sefer Karim, it's the same thing here. Once upon a time, there was a Maimon Har Sinai, Hashem revealed himself to everyone, man, woman, and child. But since then, unfortunately, he hasn't. So the first generation, it was still fresh in their mind, maybe the second generation. But how are you going to, what's that to do with you and me? The answer is, so Hashem similarly, he sent these representatives to constantly remind us, and that's the idea of parents being the embodiment of the Mesorah. I thought, and for this we'll read, because it's so beautiful, a little bit in English, one of the ones who perhaps personifies this approach and speaks about it with such eloquence is the description of Rafael Hirsch, also in his commentary on the Chumash, his commentary on the Aseret HaDibros. Now, obviously, Rafael Hirsch didn't write in English. Rafael Hirsch didn't even write in Hebrew either. Rafael Hirsch also wrote in German. There are Hebrew versions of the Chumash of Hirsch, but there's also translations. So my opinion is, once you get your translation, you might as well buy an English one. I'm not sure there's anything to Kadosh, but reading a Persian Hebrew. You might as well read them in English. If you can read them in German, you can be in the Rashavsky family, it's a halabai, brought this to you, but the rest of us, the powerful souls, so we can read a Persian English. You take a look, I don't know, maybe it's just as beautiful in the German, but we're going to have to try the English. Take a look on the left-hand side, and it says, not on the results of our research into nature, but on the actual events in the history of our people, of which God became revealed to us and made his will revealed to us, that God found our Jewish knowledge and acknowledgement of him as one who directs our faith and who is to be the guide of all of our acts. In other words, of course we can see Hashem through nature, but that's not enough. We don't rely on the fact that the people will see Hashem through nature and so they want to worship him. Rather, it's the way Hashem has related to us through history, the living history of the Jewish people is the real mechayev, the real way that cements our relationship with Hashem. But he points out in the next part where I've underlined, the knowledge and acknowledgement of historical facts. So if it's really through history that Hashem communicates with us, but how do we know that if we didn't live through that history? It depends solely on tradition. And tradition depends solely on the faithful transmission by parents to children and on the willing acceptance by children from the hands of their parents. So that continuance of God's whole great institution of Judaism rests entirely on the theoretical and practical obedience of children to parents, and Kibbutz Rabbeinu is the basic condition for the external existence of the eternal existence, thank you, of the Jewish nation. Parents are the actual bond that joins the child to the Jewish path and allows it to be a Jew or a Jewess, and they are those who are to hand over to them the Jewish mission and knowledge, morals, and education. Without this bond, the chain of generations is broken, the Jewish past is lost for the future, and the Jewish nation ceases to exist. It's a little bit important. Everything, says the Persian, depends on Kibbutz Rabbeinu. If you have reverence for your parents, you trust the tradition that they give to you, and that's the built-in. Of course, we have exceptions in both directions. We have exceptions for Goyim, people who come in without that background, and then we have people who are given every opportunity in the best families and opt out. Both exceptions exist. But the general rule, the predominant thing that we're going to rely on, so to speak, which we hope will be the rule, not the exception, is the faithful transmission from parents to children. And I think you hard to find the more eloquent representation of this general idea. Again, notice, it has nothing to do with the Hakaras HaTov. This has nothing to do with how they gave birth to you, the day they feed you and give you Nike sneakers. That's all wonderful and you should be appreciative. But according to Hirsch, that's not given a name. It's a different model. His is the idea of we have to have that reverence for our parents because that's what enables the continuation of the Torah. As was the other sources we spoke about focusing on Hakkarat Hatov. There's more sources here on the second to next page, but I want to move now into the next part of the shir, which is a quick, so to speak, blow-by of different areas of halakha that discuss some of the different relationships that are either sometimes at the same time coexisting, let's say sometimes like grandparents, or in some cases, instead of, in lieu of, because of the situation of the family, instead of, if you will, as I said, what I guess is still, you could say, the more typical, not the typical makes means better, but the more common and presumed approach, which is that we're talking about biological parents are raising the children. But there are many other models, as I say, sometimes in addition, like grandparents or in-laws, that come in place of parents that are the typical parents we're talking about, that can be in addition. There are also cases, the first two I want to mention, step-parents or adoptive parents, where for one reason or another, you have a different model of the family. And again, hopefully, we all know that those sometimes can be complicated. All families can, and this is an additional thing for families to overcome. But many do, and many have very beautiful families in such a situation. And the question is, assuming it is wonderful and beautiful, we hope, the question is, what does the halakha say about this relationship? So let's start in source number 14 with the issue of step-parents. So just to take a simple example, perhaps, wherever the biological mother is, but now we're talking about your father. Your biological father is remarried, and now he has a wife, which is what we call a stepmother. We'll use that as a test case, but of course it's just as true if it would be a mother remarrying and a stepfather. So the Gemara says, source number 14, the Sefer Ksuba Tzav Kokimel, page 103a, it's referring to the case of the time of the death of Rebbe, the great Rebbe. He tells his children, the B'ni Ani Tzarek, I want my son, my children should come near me. Nithn Subhan Avetzlo, everyone should come around the deathbed. Amar Tami, he says to them, he's about to die, is Haru Gathod Imchem. Be very careful, even after I'm gone, honor your mother. So the Gemara asks, this is what the final message he has to give the children? It's a mitzvah. They had to honor the mother the whole life until now, and they're going to have to honor the mother after the father dies. That'll be the special. It's not a favor they're doing to the father for him on his deathbed. It's a mitzvah. They have to honor the mother. So the Gemara answers very fascinatingly, this was not their biological mother. Ashes Avhaved, this was their stepmother. So he's about to pass away. He is the biological parent. And he's saying on his deathbed, please make sure I honor my wife, your stepmother. So the Gemara says, if that's the case, isn't that also a mitzvah? Ashes Av, a stepmother, Nami da Araisa hi. There's a mitzvah da Araisa to honor a step parent. The Tanya and the Braisa learns, but what does the Pasuk say? Kabe es avicha ve es imecha. Honor your father, we translate that, or honor your mother. But says the Gemara, and that could have just as easily been communicated with a shorter sentence. Kabe avicha ve kabe imecha. Why did the Torah insert in both of the clauses the word es? And when we translate the Pasuk, we ignore that word. Honor your father, honor your mother. Why does that say kabe es avicha, kabe es imecha? Says the Gemara, the S's are coming to add step-parents. Zu eshes avicha, zu baal imecha, or imecha. This is referring to a stepmother or a stepfather, which is included in the Pasuk. Then the Gemara adds at the end, but perhaps there's one difference. Ani mili mechayim, abala achar misalo. So we'll have to see how that gets translated into facts, but the first main thing you see from this Gemara is, and the post can assume this, we'll see in a minute, the Gemara seems to tell us, and again, I don't know how well this is known, unfortunately, but it's an explicit Gemara, that honoring step-parents is a mitzvah de araisa, included in the mitzvah of kibbut abe.
Isn't that for custodial parents?
Meaning not in Detroit while you're living here.
That's right. This is one that raised.
I don't know if that's true. That's not the basis of the drasha. The drasha doesn't say anything about that.
The story is such.
I don't know. Maybe these are just adult children. I don't know. You may be right. You're the analyst.
There's a complexity here also. In this case, so we don't really know this, but the question of what if you have a biological, in this case, mother
at the same time,
and a stepmother.
Those relationships are very complicated sometimes, especially if the parents are so close to the biological mother. 100%.
Does this imply the halachic implication if you have a step and a biological?
I think you have to honor them at the same time. Yeah, I would think so. So take a look, for example, at source number 15. The Rambam tells us this.
He's the last one. Who's death?
the biological parents.
Right. It's the parent, not the step parent.
No, the parent.
The Gemara, we'll see in a moment, the Rambam and I was going to talk about this, we'll get to it, that perhaps the only difference between honoring a step parent and a parent may be that we know, we saw this last week a little bit, our Gemara, should we saw more of this, that the mitzvah kibud av v'aim is even after the parent dies. But it sounds like from the Gemara here that may not be true about a step-parent. And the reason why, we'll have to get Alan was suggesting in a moment, we'll get to that. But let's see for a moment, well, first of all, what the Rambam says.
The Gemara is implying that the mitzvah is directly to the step-parent and not through the biological
parent. It depends what you mean by through.
In other words, you're not obligated in respecting the stepmother because she is an extension of the biological
maybe
father.
Yes, maybe no, but that probably is the best explanation of what might change after death.
Right.
So I'm
saying, but the fact that he separates it, he says...
I understand, but that, if you say what you're saying too strongly, you don't understand anything of Marla. So look at start number 15. Look, I just want to move on, because we're not going to get through enough. Let's just try to move on a little bit. Chayav Odo B'chavid is Eches Aviv Al-Fisha Eno Imo, even though it's not the biological mother. But he adds, and here's an important caveat, Cold Mash Aviv Kayav, Shized Bechlal Kvod Aviv. Part of your obligation for the biological parent is to honor the step-parent, is to honor the one that they've married. And therefore, says the Rambam, La'achar Misasav, Eina Chayav. Then there is no more obligation. So what do we see until now? And I just quickly, before we summarize, let's just see quickly, source number 16. I'll just say it out again. This is from our new friend, the Sefer Haredim, who point out explicitly, in case you weren't sure, that the mitzvah of honoring a step-parent, he says, is da'araisa. It's an absolute Torah obligation. And to give you an example, he says in 16, where the point is that it's not just conceptually, but the details. All the things you have to do for the biological parent, you have to do for the step-parent. So in source number 16, in the second line, he's talking about the fact you have to stand up for a parent. So he says that's true for a step-parent also. Or fascinating, in source 17, that's from the introduction of the Chafetz Chaim. So some of you have studied that Sefer. The Chafetz Chaim starts off the Sefer by listing, every time you speak Lashon Hara, in theory, how many Averos did you have? And I think he has something like 30-something Averos who could be over. You say Lashon Hara, the right person at the right time. Or should I say the wrong person at the wrong time? Not just like one thing called Lashon Hara. It's like 100, you know, whatever Averos. So in his group, one of the things he mentions, which is obviously a variable, not as constant, is what if the person you say Lashon Hara about is your parent? That has been known to happen. Especially after they revisit it. After they left, there's lots of Lashon Hara by the parents. So, says the Chafetz Chaim, that's an additional violation, not only the Averus of Lashon Hara per se, but say Lashon Hara about a parent is a violation of Kibbut Avim. And there, source number 17, he's explicit. Baal Imo, Heshes Aviv, Gamkein over Gamkein, Amusas Asay the Kibbut. Say Lashon Hara about your stepmother. Say Lashon Hara about your stepfather, it's the same violation as if you said Lashon Hara about your father or your mother. And also the Chafetz Chaim. It's an explicit halacha from Chaim, which makes sense from the Gemara, from the Rambam, from the Sefer HaRedim. It's a mitzvah to araisa to honor a stepmother and a stepfather. And what's fascinating, and could be potentially sensitive, and I would think abused by someone who's looking to be manipulative, is that it does seem to be clear that conceptually what's going on here is something not totally independent of the actual biological parents. In other words, in light of the sources we started with, and this is really why I structured the sheer way I did, there's no question, especially to take Marcel's point, if this was a, well, the term you use, custodial parent, meaning this was a parent that raised you. For example, my grandfather, my paternal grandfather died when I was two. My parents, my father is already a grown man, he already has no children. My grandmother's been remarried for almost 20 years or so. Right, so he's a wonderful person. But he didn't raise my father. It wasn't just that he didn't give birth to my father. He didn't raise my father. My father was already an adult. So that's a different relationship. It could be that it's close, and thankfully we have a close family. But that's not the same thing as your parent getting remarried when you're 4 years old. Of course, that's going to be a different relationship. It could be more difficult sometimes, unfortunately. But potentially, if it goes well, it could be more closer to what you would expect from a biological parent. No question about that. So in light of the idea we saw in the beginning of the shiur about Hakaras HaTov, especially if you focus on Hakaras HaTov of raising you, which we saw that the sources did. So if it's a custodial parent, you would have expected that to translate. And you might have thought that that's what's going on. And it may be going on in a second. We'll see from some subsequent sources. But if we would stop here, the Rambam especially, the way he formulates it, it sounds like that's not what's going on. It sounds like what's going on is that the honor that you have for your father, in our example, your biological parent includes, by definition, his wife. So the honor you have for your biological mother includes her husband. And that's why I'm so sure to put in the Rambam formulation, in a certain sense, it's, if you will, expansion. Because it wouldn't be limited at all to a custodial relationship. Because it's not so much about what they did for you, but about who they are, namely, for the spouse of your parents. And part of that kibbutz you have for your parent includes their spouse. Why do I say this? Because that would seem to explain the limitation that is implied by the Gemara and crystallized very clearly by the Rambam, which is that from a strict technical halakhic perspective, says the Rambam, when the biological parent passes away, that mitzvah, which we have said is the araisa mitzvah of honoring the step-parent, apparently goes away. The mitzvah to honor the step-parent is in the lifetime of the biological parent. But when the biological parent passes away, so you may have a relationship, and I have known families in which both things happen. I've known relationships in where it was so close for so many years that the relationship can maintain. I know other families in which once there was no biological, you know, once there was no connection, it naturally faded because they obviously hadn't been close to begin with. And like Nebuch, they were forced to be polite to each other because they had a family member in common. But once that family member had passed on, so there was no relationship. So that seems to be what's crystallized in the Rambam. I'm going to take the question in a second, but I just want to add that it's not so simple. It's not according to all authorities. Because if you take a look at the next two sources, first of all, you have from the Rishonim in Sittur number 18, the Sefer Sakot, known as the Smak, who says that may be true on the Araisa level, but unlike Rambam, who doesn't say anything else, he adds that there's still a mitzvah Yiravanan to honor the step parent even after the death of the biological parent. And the Shulchan Aruch has a vague but very intriguing phrase. One that I've used in the past in speaking to people in the situation, which is that even if technically there is no mitzvah, it's certainly the right thing to do, especially if there had been a custodial relationship. And in fact, that's exactly what the Shulchan Aruch says. Even after he seems to quote the Rambam and says that after the death of the biological parent, there is no more mitzvah, says the Rambam in the underlying source number 19, when we call Makom, Dovar Hogun Lechabdom Ah La'achamisa. It's the right thing to do. The menschlich thing to do to show them that honor even after the death of the parent. And that could be for any one of a number of reasons. I'm speculating. If there had been a custodial relationship, they raised you, then it's obvious. Even if they didn't raise you, this was someone that your father loved, this was someone that your mother loved, it may even be in a certain extent, that could be an extension of the honor you still owe your parent even after their death, to love their spouse, or to at least, you know, show that honor to the spouse. I'm not sure. Shalom doesn't tell us why. I'm speculating. But either way, you have at least two sources, sources number 18 and 19, and 19 is perhaps even more important because of the Shulchan Aruch, that's our professor, who makes the point that even though there is a technical difference between when the biological parents are alive or dead, fundamentally it really should not change our behavior, it should not change our attitude, because there's a relationship, whether it's independent or not, there's a relationship that has already been established, which in the lifetime of the biological parent created an absolute obligation, a Torah obligation. That doesn't just disappear. Relationship doesn't just disappear. And at the very least, the menschlich, and perhaps even more, maybe even the mitzvah of the Rabbanon, relationship is to continue the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av'im, even after the death of the biological parent. But let me stress, because again, I don't know if this is well enough known, in the life, as long as hopefully the parents are alive, the biological parents are alive, then it's an absolute obligation, a mitzvah to Araisa, to have Kibbutz just as much, every detail, as you have for the biological parent, must have for the step parent as well. Yes?
My question is, what happens when there hasn't kavod for both parents, or for a step-parent, is a lack of kavod, for example, there's an acrimony of support.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's say the father...
I can only imagine there's innumerable examples that you
right,
can come up with.
An easy example is, you know, the original mother feels that this other woman broke up her marriage.
Yeah, oh boy.
She's now the stepmother.
Could I ask you an easy question? If this is being taped, you know, people are going to listen to this, and I want to look good. I don't know. I should say I don't know. I don't want too much. You have to, each case has to be handled individually. Those can be very, very delicate. No, what I would say, just to point out, without getting, it's not necessarily comparable, but the fact that there could be competing obligations is not new to Judaism. We often have cases where there's competing mitzvah values. And it's not even knew to keep it out of aim. Again, not that this is identical, this is not a topic that I'm prepared to speak about, but the Gemara already talks about what if you have competing obligations from father and mother. So certainly from stepmother and biological mother that could be competing. You know, LaMarshall, this happens in every one of these situations at weddings. Who's going to walk down the children? Right? This guy, right? So sometimes if there's really a horrible divorce, then it works out well, because I was in a case that was so terrible where all those years later they still couldn't imagine, they hate each other so much, the husband and wife, ex-husband and wife, that they couldn't even walk down the children together. But at least it helped, because then they were okay, so the two fathers are better. But let's say everyone loved the children, the children loves everyone, and then you're stuck, right? So you would imagine, for example, I assume, you know, instinctively, but okay, the two biological parents, but you're right, then you're, you know, you're leaving the third, you know, she's reminded that she's just a stepmother. No question about it. Maybe that's the right thing to do then. I'm not saying it's not. But you're right. Those situations can come up, even in the best of circumstances, where you have competing values, and those have to be, I would say the only rule of thumb is that there is no rule. Each one of those cases has to be handled individually. But there's no question that they are difficult situations. Yes?
We have here, especially the comment made about to the Machabeg test.
Right.
Is there a distinction between Machabeg and requirements? I mean, do you have the obligation
good question.
To your stepmother's nursing home?
Wow.
Could be significant.
Yeah.
The father's no longer alive. And maybe there are other sources of money.
Right.
Do I have nothing?
So the question about financial obligation is actually going to be part of the separate question, which is even true about whether you owe your parents, biological parents, is that supposed to cost you? And that will be part of next week's show. So I can find out that one. Yeah. Yes.
So then when Rebbe says to his students, to his children, and
right. Honor my wife.
He's going to be sure to be in there? You think because after I die, you don't have to?
Oh, very good, because unless you want to look at the Gemara for like the next 3 days or something until he dies, that seems to be a proof that there is, at least in that story, that he was expecting something even after he died. That's right. I think so the Rambam would say yes. The Rambam would assume yes, because that's supposed to be sure that not obligated, and that may be the language of the Shulchan Aruch when he called it a Dover Hogan. Because again, that seems to be, again, you could read that as very much the best way to read the Gemara, because if it was the obligation, it doesn't need to ask, it doesn't need to be a deathbed wish. Why is he making it a deathbed wish? Because of the measures are then. Okay. Any other questions on this? Yes.
I have an instance where a friend of mine, her father passed away, the stepmother literally moved out of the country back to her home country.
Well, she's not having any interest. She has no interest in having a relationship. So then, I assume that would be what we would call, in our terminology, mechila. She has forgiven the obligations that you may want to bestow upon her. She's obviously uninterested. I do not think you need to chase her around the world. Right. Is something we need to talk about, Aaron? Because we're coming back to that. Okay. Let's do a few more sources here. Let's start with source number 20. For the sake of time, I'm going to try to move a little bit faster, because we really have so much more to do. Source number 20, a whole group of sources that follow it, are the question of adoptive parents. So you can have a child who, for whatever reason, is not being raised by either of his biological parents, and you have these tzaddikim, there's no other word for it, tzaddikim, who are willing to take on the relationship, even if there is some self-interest. Now, getting back to that safer house, it doesn't matter. Anyone who's willing to raise children that they can give birth to is, in my book, already a tzaddik. Assuming that they act that way as an adoptive parent. I'm not talking about these horror stories from the news.
Sometimes people just aren't able to have children, so they adopt.
Right, and I think that's wonderful. It may help them, which is good, but it's also wonderful to do to begin with. To me, it's a wonderful thing. And how do I know that? The Gemara told me. The Gemara told me in source number 20, the Gemara bestows such a beautiful honor. The Gemara says, call him a gadol, yosu, so if you raise a child that's not your own, you adopt the child. The Torah makes it as if you gave birth to them. You're like the mamish, their parents. How mamish is mamish? So at source number 21, the great Shlomo Kluger, one of the great poskim of Galicia, he asked the question halachically. He doesn't come with a definitive answer, but it shows you how seriously he takes it. He wants to know, if somebody adopts a boy and a girl, are they going to fulfill the mitzvah of Pruvu Ravu? It's a biblical mitzvah. It's the first mitzvah in the Torah. And the Gemara Paskins that Beis Hillel says you need to have one son and one daughter, minimally, that is fulfilled. Biblical is a furu. So someone who can't have any children who adopts a boy and a girl, or someone who had a boy, and then he adopts a daughter, or vice versa, does he how seriously to take it. But the very fact that he's unsure shows how seriously we should take it. Obviously, it's making a very dramatic statement about what it means to raise a child that you didn't give birth to. I'll leave source number 22 for you. It's a beautiful part of an essay that was recently published in Solidation, where he traces back these two types of relationships we can have with children, biological as well as educational, all the way back to Abraham before he had a hay in his name and after he had a hay in his name, and how the hay has to do with the teaching, the fact that if we teach children and we raise them, but that's as if we, so to speak, are their parents. It's like Abraham was the Av Hamon Goyim. He was the father of all the people that he taught and brought to monotheism. There's a whole model of fatherhood. And again, by extension, motherhood, we know, started in the same thing. And he ties that in from a philosophical, not a logical, philosophical perspective, the very beauty of what it means to have an adoptive child. So bottom line, with all the nice, beautiful hashkafa, what's the halacha? Does the mitzvah of kibbutz ha'aim apply to adoptive parents? Or not? And this is a very tricky question. Again, it could certainly be sensitive in situations where this is relevant. And most of the post-team seem to assume, again, if you want to look at it in a narrow technical sense of kibbutz ha'aim, that the answer is no, that there is not an obligation. The proof for this comes from a Gemara and a Rashi in the Maseches Sota. This is sources number 23 and 24. We have a situation where one of the great proponents of the Gemara raised a child. And towards the end, at some point later in the adulthood, asks him for water, and the child taunts the adoptive parent. I mean, this is cruel. The Gemara acknowledges this is cruel. The Gemara is full of the good, the bad, and the ugly. The Gemara has a cruel story where this child taunts the person and basically says, "Nan, nan, nan, I'm here, not my father." Pretty much, that's the translation from Aramaic to English. The Gemara seems to leave it at that. If you take a look at Rashi in source number 3, the last Rashi, and what's the therefore? Right, look at the second class Rashi. Gidilosi, you raised me. But I'm not your son. You didn't give birth to me. And the result, as I'm teasing you, seems to be, Ve'en alai l'chavdecha kebed. And therefore, I shouldn't have to honor you like a son. And sure enough, in source number 25, in the landmark Tshuva, the Chasam Sofer rules based on this Rashi. It doesn't seem to be debated anywhere else in the Talmud. That from a technical perspective, and it's clear this is a horrible thing. No one's defending the action of this child in the Gemara. But since it's not challenged on halakhic grounds, maybe on ethical grounds, but on halakhic grounds, Chasam Sofer says, you see from this, Hayosom Eino Mitsuva B'mitzvahs, Eino B'mitzvahs Asei L'chavdo K'mavur L'hedri B'sokto B'rashi. There's no strict obligation, the general demanding obligation of Kibbutz Ha'aim does not apply for an adoptive parent on behalf of that child. Then he points out, though, but, you know, come on, Afilu Yelo, Tzas Mitzvahs Kibbutz, Yenuchi L'shtadel, L'Kaddish, L'Rabba, etc. Perhaps some level of Kibbutz, and maybe they would say Kaddish, maybe they wouldn't, he's not sure. Nevertheless, he says, it's certainly not the same as if you had two, so to speak, competing Avelim, someone who lost an adoptive parent and someone who lost a biological parent. You would not look at them, he's talking about a very specific question of who gets the Davin, you know, my rib, the jewel. He says you would not look at them as two people with equal claims on the chazan. The one who lost the biological parent would certainly come first. Now, I just want to mention, this is some of the sources I have here on the page. The first, December 25th, I was in Baltimore. Yeshiva Rambam invited me to have Yom Yun, and I gave a shiur on this topic, and I was focusing not only on kibbutz ha'aim, but also chalila when the person dies, on whether there's a velus or not, which is the inverse, you know, a flip side of the same topic. And I mentioned there that just like there is no technical mitzvah of kibbutz ha'aim, it seems clear from the posting that technically speaking there is no obligation for a velus, and yet it is the opinion, certainly I know of Rav Herschel Schachter, he quotes his oil in the name of Rav Soloveitchik, that it's certainly allowed, and perhaps, or Schachter says at least, even encouraged. And I don't have time, we're just running late on time, but it's based on two things. One, which is not relevant for our share tonight, which are sources number 26 and 27, which is a chiddush in Avelus, that there is such a concept in Avelus of what he calls a kiyum, but without a chiyum, even though you're not obligated in Avelus, you can still have an embodiment of it. That's not our topic tonight. But also, given the fact that we have the topics we raised at the beginning of this year, the Hakaras HaTov, the basic Meshlachkeit, indecency, that if someone raised you, I mean, you can take an extreme example, not all cases are like this, but, you know, that's like Annie, you know, you're, someone who would have been otherwise in an orphanage, someone raises you, so to be so obtuse and so which is the Gemara story, it's a cool story, I don't have to give you a cup of water. I mean, it's a horrible thing. It's not the right thing to do. The mental thing to do in their lifetime, of course, is to have Kibbutz Avim for them, without a doubt. And if, when it comes to after death, so he points out here, chapter, that there's no reason, if they want, they're not obligated, but if they want, there's no reason they shouldn't sit Shiva. And perhaps it should even be encouraged. Now, I've mentioned, the people have asked me this in the past, that I know at least one other of the contemporary poskim who disagrees, because this happened in my family. I mentioned my father's father passed away at a young age. So my father's aunt, my grandfather's brother's wife, she died in a very tragic fire on Erev Pesach, and there were some young children, and my uncle had a very difficult time, and 2 years later he got remarried, and they had some children together, some of whom actually live in Baltimore, but also she raised these other 2 children. And a number of years ago, when she passed away, this was the only mother that they knew, because their mother died when they were like 4 and 2, the children in the first marriage. And they, all the other children were sitting shiva, of course, and these 2 asked a different well-known posek in New York, and he told them not to sit shiva. And I can tell you, I'm not questioning strictly from a halakhic perspective, but emotionally, it was certainly the wrong
part. Are you defining adopted as a legal adoption in this situation or not?
I mean,
because this is like a step parent. It's the same thing about a step parent.
The difference between the step parent and the adoptive, in that case.
In this case, with.
My story. You're right. I take it back. I want you to know something. I didn't even realize I was talking. You're right. I'm not being precise. The story I'm giving you is about a step parent. You're right.
So let's go back to a step parent. Is there any.
I don't think there's an obligation, but the comment, this is why I confuse it. Point of Rashefta would be just equally the same. But just to point out, that this is where it comes to the fore, certainly for the adopted, which is the case Rashefta's talking about here in source number 28, is that he specifically focuses on Shiva as opposed to Shloshim or certainly Yud Beis Chodesh. He says because the 12 months, the whole year, that's a direct outgrowth of the technical obligation of Kibbutz Avim. So that doesn't exist, but certainly not from a technical perspective, the adoptive parent. And even when it comes to the step parent, it sounds like once if the biological parent's not alive, it wouldn't be applicable. But I don't know of anybody who would say, it's interesting though, I never thought about it until you caught me on that. I'm glad you do it. I'm going to think about it a little bit more. If you have a step parent who passes away and your biological parent is still alive, would anyone say that you have to keep a bailiff for 12 months? I don't think anyone would say such a thing.
Have it sitting shiva.
So I don't know if you have to sit shiva. I don't know if anyone says that either. But I certainly think that, again, of course, it would be the same thing as the adoptive. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And, again, if I was the rabbi, I would probably take case by case, each one individually. But if that was something that I could easily see being appropriate in certain cases. Now, again, I know at least one case, it was a cousin of mine, where they were told not to. And I'm not sure, frankly, that was the right decision. But these are things which are obviously sensitive and need to be understood and analyzed on a case-by-case basis. So we're not, the format of a shiur like this is not to discuss or tackle those very sensitive personal situations, but certainly to start to give a more broader framework to understand that. The framework, which I think is relevant, whether you talk about the step parent, which has a certain, if you will, quote, advantage, that there's a relationship to marriage to the biological parent, or you have the adoptive parent, which on the one hand is, of course, wonderful, the Gemara extols it tremendously, but at the same time, you have no biological connection. And you see from this Gemara that ultimately, when push comes to shove, what's the point of emphasis? What's the machayev? You gave birth. You gave the child life. That's the only explanation for why there is this fundamental difference, despite the fact that an adoptive parent might have raised a child since they were 5 days old. It's certainly possible. Can you imagine? The love might be just as real as any other relationship. From a technical legal perspective, they didn't give birth to them. And the technical legal obligation of Kibbutz Avim seems to be limited, unless it's because of a step relationship, and then you have the marriage which creates that. If it's just the adoptive situation, so then you have maybe Mir Rabbanan, you have Dover Hogan, it's the right thing to do, Akar Satov. Someone who's, again, like this Gemara, someone who's irreverent to an adoptive parent, I can't think of anything more low. It's lower than a biological child who is a parent. And any sensitivity to what it means for someone to have adopted you and to raise you, and to treat them like this is a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. And I'm not just speaking legally. Because after the time of the Gemara, they didn't have legal adoption, which is you. It's with God and Yosef the Rezo. This is the person who raised you. They took you into their home and they loved you like a child. you should reciprocate. And if you don't, there's no heter in the world that would excuse such behavior. Yeah.
So the fact that there is no chiyuv for kibbutz or aid for adoptive parents, and in actual fact, the status is the same for adoptive as step parents, in that they're not biological, that would support then that the step parents, the chiyuv for step parents,
to the biological.
Yes.
Yes. Good.
Yes. Actually, kibbutz for the biological.
Correct. Good.
Parents.
Yes. Very good. Yeah. Good. Good. Listen, the conversation and the topics are so great, but we're really going to run late. I want to try to finish in a few more minutes. I apologize. We only have one sheet to go, but we'll try to fly through it. This is, now we're moving into relationships which are not necessarily alternatives to the biological, you know, father and mother, and maybe you have versus adoptive versus step. Here we have the last page. We have two more categories of cases, which are basically things which every, hopefully, child who has a wonderful life will have both of these as well. Some people have grandparents. And in our generation, probably Shomer Blessed, my mother's generation was unheard of to have grandparents. Not like everyone was killed in the war. But we're in a generation, unfortunately, where we have grandparents. And hopefully we'll get married and our spouse will have parents. And then we have in-laws. And I never liked in-laws jokes because there's real halachos about in-laws. So just to give you a sense, sources 29 through 32 are about grandparents. And it's really very fascinating. The tshuva, I wish I had more time. The main source, the well-known source for this, is a tshuva written by the Rama, the great Rama from the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama of Krakow. So he has a tshuva to someone who wanted to know if he's allowed to say Kaddish for his grandparents. So again, there, the point is mentioned that it's not at the same level as obligation of someone to say Kaddish for their actual parents. But he says, not only is it allowed, there is some level of a chiyuv. Why? Because he quotes the halacha, the nevanim hari en kevanim. The grandchildren are like children. And even though there are other sources, says the Rama, who are aware of that phrase in the Talmud, but they have a very limited conception of it, says the Rama, in my opinion, that's meant to be understood as broadly as possible, that there's a, it's maybe a level B, it's a lower level, but there's a level of kibbutz, if you will, in this case, grandparents or grandmother, kibbutz avim, that is owed by grandchildren to their grandparents. And in fact, there's a well-known medrash in Sefer Bereishis which seems to support this as well. It's talking here, I have this in the middle, Rashi Vayigash quotes this, where it speaks about Yaakov and Yitzchak, and the idea that the medrash says is how you have to have more kibbutz for your father. But it's the implication that Rashi and the Rama say, you see from that medrash, maybe you have to have more for your parent than your grandparent. But it's clear by implication that you have to have some level of obligation of kibbutz avim, or what you call kibbutz kavod sata, kibbutz lavi v'zedi, to the grandparents. And the Rama himself in Shulchan Aruch on source number 30, he quotes, he's intellectually honest, he's not, even though he wrote the book, you would say it's all just private, it's only quote his own opinion. But he actually here quotes both opinions. He mentions that there are those who say technically that there's no obligation, but then he says, ain't when you're really in source 30, that's not my opinion. He holds chayiv the kibbutz avim. So maybe it's more for the grandparent, for the parent, but it's obvious that there is some level of obligation even for the grandparent. And to conclude this section, source number 31, the Sefer HaKharedim says again, based on that medrash, mashma the shnehem mid oraisa. There's a oraisa obligation, the Torah obligation to honor your grandparents. Ella, but obviously, the chayiv tzvein is like no, but it's not on the same par level as your parents. It's a little lower than the gvudim zignoso, not just your grandfather, but your grandmother as well. The grandchildren are very much an extension of children, and therefore, just like as we know, those of you fortunate to be in the category know better than I, the love of grandparents that they have for grandchildren is certainly the same, if not even greater, as the old joke goes. Right? This is when I had my first child. My in-laws were in the hospital, Rabbi Lutzke came to make a visit, and it was the first grandchildren on both on either side. So my in-laws and Rabbi Lutzke had the old joke. I know how good grandchildren would have been. I would have had them first. So, Menevonim Hari and Kabanim. That's the joking version of that halacha, that people love grandchildren better. Therefore, the obligations in the other direction are the same as well. Grandchildren owe their grandparents, again, maybe not exactly the same level as their parents. And again, on both levels, whether it's the general educational, emotional components you're going to get from the grandparents, and certainly you need to look at it from a biological perspective. So it wouldn't be for the grandparents having the father or the mother. I wouldn't be here either. So we have a broad, if you will, imagination. We don't just look in one generation. We even look back two generations. just as an aside, because we were talking, we got caught up on the issue of the step-parent, but in death versus after death, so it is worth noting that Rabbi Akiva Eiger here in source number 32 quotes an opinion that says that the honor you owe grandparents is only in their lifetime. But when grandparents die, the idea of kibbud, even after death, does not apply to grandparents. It's interesting, but it's also worth noting that that's 100% against the Ramah. Because if you remember, the Ramah's whole case where he got started with this was with the grandparent who died, and you want to know if you're having kaddish. But obviously, his whole discussion is talking about a case where the grandparent had already died, and he assumes there's an obligation. So even though, just I'm putting this on the sheet, just so you should know there's this opinion out there, but it seems to me, if we're going to go with the Ramah, so not only is there a mitzvah d'oraisa to honor your grandparents, but it even is true after they have passed off.
Hey, really,
it two more minutes to conclude, and it's just a coincidence and nothing more that we're short-changing the in-laws in this year. There's nothing just a coincidence, nothing to be read into it. I have the world's greatest in-laws. 11 years of marriage, we haven't gotten to one fight.
Thank
God. In all seriousness. Course number 33 through the end, I have the issue of in-laws. And here we have the following halacha. The Gemara, I give you as an example. I won't get into the details. It's incredibly technical and far-flung, having to do with Kohanim and the firstborn animals which they're owed. But the bottom line is here, in the context of testimony, for the benefit or the detriment of the family of the Kohen, so the Gemara says the children of the Kohen can testify about a certain animal, but not the Kohen's wife. Why? The Gemara, famous well-known phrase, this is the source, Ishto kegufo dam. You look at husband and wife not as two separate people, but in some very profound way as one combined unit. That's, you know, from the Shabbat brothers, Torah. So here's a halachic component. It's not just a nice bracha under the chuppah. It's not just a dvar Torah over dinner. It's a real halacha according to this Gemara. And in fact, the Medrash in Tehillim, source number 34, quotes an example from Shmuel Aleph, where David, referring to his father-in-law, Shaul, refers to him as in the term of an Av or Aviv, and the Medrash says, you see from here, Nathan, from here we see, Shechayev Adam v'chvod chamav, kik v'chvod Aviv. That you have to have an obligation for your father-in-law, like you do for your father. And again, going back to our new friend, the Sefer Haredim, in source number 35, this is how he quotes the halacha, why you have to have Chayev v'chvod chamav v'chamoso, you have to obligate to honor your father-in-law and your mother-in-law, the time when we show him the ish for isho kechad gufo hashiva, ba'av ve'em shel zeh, ke'av ve'em shel zeh. What a beautiful language. So if you and your wife are like one person, so your wife's parents are like your parents. If you and your husband are like one person, so your husband's parents are like your parents. And of course you're obligated to honor them, because it's as if they're really your parents. So I'll just mention at the end, the Vilna Gaon has a very famous Musar letter towards the end of his life, and he adds there also at the end that he's asking, Bosi Lavaki Shlishti, I'm asking my wife, Shtachabe Le'imi Shkmos Akostav Batorah. He assumes, the Vilna Gaon, even though it's not written anywhere really in the Torah, but he assumes, at least in his letter, that the obligation to honor your in-laws is a Doraisa component of the Kibbud Av V'Eim. And if you take a look, we'll conclude the shir by mentioning the Shulchan Aruch with the comments of a Pshat Yad Kohen Rappaport, Pshat, verses 37 and 38. The Shulchan Aruch reads, Chayv Adam L'chabe Chamov. One has to honor the father-in-law, and again, it's true about the mother-in-law as well. And the Shah comments, in the name of the Bach, the Hainu, Shesomchu B'mitzas, Chavar L'chibur. So he says, well, maybe not identical as much as your own parents, but at least an amount. It's like you're supposed to show reverence to any of the elderly people in the community. So your in-laws, even when they're not so old, so they're as if they're old, they have that idea. In other words, in all seriousness, you have a little bit of machlokas, it seems like, at the end here, whether the obligation to honor in-laws is on the same level and on par with your parents. Maybe that's a little too ambitious. The shock is to say perhaps it's not such a high level of obligation, but just like we saw, grandparents might be a little bit of a lower level, so too in-laws might be a little bit of a lower level. So what we saw in tonight's shiur, just to sum up, and I really do thank you for your indulgence and your patience, and I hope it was worthwhile for everyone, is that we saw two different basic explanations for Kibbud Av V'Eim. it a question of appreciation, hakaras hatov, either because they gave birth to us or because they raised us, or is it a second, very fascinating possibility that through our reverence and awe and love of our parents, that creates a certain respect for authority, which is a model which can be used either societally, as the Rambam says, or like many other sources say, that the whole basis of our Masorah, we have more respect and reverence for Rabbanim, for Chachamim, through our reverence for our parents that teaches us to respect authority, to accept the Masorah as we get it from our parents. And in light of those background information we discussed, not only the classical situation of a biological parent raising children, but some of the other examples, whether they be adoptive parents, step-parents, grandparents, I'll just close with one story. I don't know if you may have heard this from me. I mentioned it perhaps sometimes on Tisha B'Av, but it's so perfectly appropriate for tonight's topic that I can't let this occasion go without mentioning it. That was a story that took place when Rav Soloveitchik was sitting Shiva for one of the relatives of his who died, and Rav Huttner and Rav Teitz both came to pay a Shiva call. And what were they discussing? Why is it that you wait, we have to have Shiva to the Avelis a whole 12 months for a parent, whereas, God forbid, someone would lose a child. Everyone knows what greater tragedy is it than that? An elderly parent passes away. It's sad, but that's a Nahog Shavuot. That's the world. To lose a child is an indescribable catastrophe, and yet that's only a month. And this is a whole year. So different answers were given. But the two most basic answers that really relate to topics we saw this year. So one was, yes, you're right, Avelis is really only 30 days. So why do we have the extra months for the parent? The mitzvah, to keep it up the hang. And the other idea, which if I'm not mistaken, came from Rav Huttner, is, and until I was preparing for this year, I didn't have all this background to appreciate that story, because he said the reason that we have the extra year for the parents is that we're not just mourning them as parents, we're mourning them as a link in the Minnesota. Because we're one step removed from that, exemplar of that generation. So that story comes to life in light of the sources that we've seen here. And the main hope, of course, for all of us is that we should be blessed with loving families, whether we're the child or the parent, and that the relationships that we have should be loving and nurturing. And these halachos should be nice, interesting, theoretical, but the ideal, of course, is that the instinctive relationship should be so loving and so dedicated that these halachos are almost an afterthought, because we are blessed with children who treat us this way, and we hopefully treat our parents and grandparents this way, of loving them and treating them. And hopefully by doing that, as mentioned earlier this year, so hopefully we'll be merited to have such families. And here's Hashem, as was mentioned by Dave Arbonell in the reverse so beautifully, the basis of our whole religion, of our whole community, is to have those loving, solid families. And Mr. Shem, we should all be blessed with those. We'll meet next week at the home of Rabbi Levi Levin to have our concluding series here. And those topics will discuss some of the challenging situations of Kibbutz Av Ein. Financially, if that comes up, sometimes there are issues where parents want you to do something, which may or may not be against halacha, or at least not the way you want to live your life. And we'll also discuss, if we have a moment as well, some of the issues that may come up when you have elderly parents who are very ill, and some of the issues that are delicate, sometimes. And that will be the topic.